Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Squawker Talker podcast. With the Premier League back at full pace here on the Talker, we are building up to a massive, huge, blockbuster showbiz weekend in the Premier League title race. Manchester City versus Liverpool is the headline act, not just of this weekend, potentially of the entire season. Pep and Klopp go head to head, but despite all the attention being on the Etihad, there is a big, big weekend packed with Premier League predictions all to come on today's show. We'll be giving our suggestions, calls and theories for all 10 games this weekend, with a special slot reserved for City against Liverpool at the end of part one of the podcast. Part two of today's show continues the Manchester City-Liverpool theme and the story, the deeper story behind Pep versus Klopp, City versus Liverpool, Merseyside versus Manchester, and all the rest of it, as we ask the big, big question: is Pep's Manchester City and Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool the greatest ever rivalry in Premier League history? Big question, and nobody is going to agree on it. I can tell you that for sure. So, plenty to get through on a busy show today. My name is Fergal Brennan, and joining me as ever to get through it all is Squawker's chief football writer, Mohammed Butt. Busy weekend, crunch weekend. Are you ready?
I'll tell you what, after Karim Benzema last night, I'm ready for anything, mate. After two hat-tricks in a row, he's got me hyped. You know, you've got Barcelona tonight in the Europa League. I'm really, you know, I'm feeling really good. La Liga's back on top, baby. And it's not about La Liga at all, but, you know, just had to get that in there. Get the little dig in there. Also, obligatory Pedri mention. Nothing to do with anything, but, you know, Pedri's great.
Just to get him in.
Yeah, Premier League's going to be good. It's a very, very good weekend. Some very tasty fixtures. And I've got some pretty spicy takes lined up.
And it is a massive weekend. And alongside Mo, we also have Football London correspondent Kaya Kainak. It is huge. Arsenal still massive role to play in the race for top four. There might not be as much attention on the Gunners this weekend, but it's a huge weekend all round.
Yeah, I can't think why. Is there a big game on this weekend? I don't know. No one's really mentioned it. There might be something going on elsewhere. But yeah, feeling good and looking forward to an exciting weekend at Premier League football.
Brilliant stuff. Right, we're going to jump straight into predictions for this weekend of Premier League action. Game week 32, which means there's only 7 weekends of Premier League football left this season. So we're going to start in chronological order. We're going to go right the way through from the Friday night action all the way through to that big one on Saturday afternoon with Manchester City up against Liverpool. So, Kaya, we're going to get started. Friday night action, the Friday night lights at St. James's Park. Newcastle are home to Wolves. Wolves looking to put some pressure on Manchester United in the race for Europe. 3 wins in their last 5 in the Premier League, including that local derby against Aston Villa last time out. Newcastle probably done enough to be safe, but no wins in 3. What's your call for this?
I think we should just take a minute to sort of take a look at why this game has been chosen to be televised. It's very confusing for me because there's so many exciting matches this weekend. There's lots of relegation 6-pointers. And Sky have gone for probably the most pointless game of the weekend. With all due respect to Wolves and Newcastle, they're both safe. I don't think Wolves are going to probably qualify for Europe. I think Newcastle aren't going to go down. So this game has so little riding on it. It's a proper sort of end of season, mid-table clash. But that doesn't mean it's not going to be entertaining because there is lots of exciting things at play. I think Newcastle, I would make them just about favourites for this one just because of the form they're on. I know, obviously, they looked really poor defensively against Spurs last weekend, but they'll be wanting to bounce back from that. And in front of their home crowd, I'd back them for a 1-0 win because I just don't think Wolves are going to score up against what looks like a better Newcastle defence, especially if they can improve from last week.
Moving on from Friday to Saturday, Mo, we're going to give you your first shout, and it's a personal one because it involves Manchester United. Everton welcoming United to Goodison Park. Everton are in a mess. We're recording this podcast on the back of them losing away at Burnley last night. But as bad as things are for Frank Lampard and Everton, would it actually be a bit of a shock if United got it together and got a positive result at Goodison?
Look, Everton were 16th when Lampard got the job. They've won just 2 of 9 games in the league since. They're 17th now. They're bad. They're bad and they're going to get relegated because Yerry Mina is the key to that defence. I always joke with Jake that he was the best defender in the world. Obviously, he's not, but he's clearly much better than even we used to give him credit for because he's played 8 games this season. Everton lost just 2 of them, both to Aston Villa. And they've lost to Newcastle, but he got injured when it was 1-0 Everton, so that doesn't count. In the 21 games they've played, they've lost 16 times. The 25 rate loss rate with him, 76 rate loss rate without him. What, you know, They're dead in the water. Lampard's useless. Even Man United can't mess this one up. Let's put it that way. United are a mess themselves. They've got their own problems. But, you know, Cristiano probably has decided he'll play this weekend. So they'll actually have a striker because, of course, Ragnar doesn't seem to rate Rashford at all. As long as Ilanga can stop tackling his own players as they're about to score last-minute winners, United should win this one, I reckon. 3-1 United. Everton are really, really bad and they're going to get relegated.
Okay, right. We're going to keep going with the Saturday games. Throw it back over to you, Kaya. And this is a big one for Arsenal at home to Brighton this weekend. Obviously, on the back of losing to Palace in Monday night action, top four position is under threat. Spurs obviously winning last weekend. Manchester United, Mo's obviously given a positive prediction for them to win, which would put a bit more pressure on Arsenal. But I want to actually talk about the team situation because there's two massive injury stories coming out of Arsenal this week. Kieran Tierney has been ruled out until next season. Big, big blow for Arsenal. And Thomas Partey is also likely to miss at least 2 to 3 weeks of action. So Kieran Tierney is a huge player for Arsenal. Nuno Tavares came in against Crystal Palace and it was tough going for him. We know he had that issue against Nottingham Forest in the FA Cup when he got hooked off and he was very annoyed. Clearly hasn't learned a lot of lessons. Mikel Arteta needs a Kieran Tierney plan. What is it?
Yeah, it was tough for Nuno. He was kind of thrown to the wolves on Monday night just because of the system Arsenal play now. He obviously came into the team earlier in the season in October and looked pretty good. But back then, Arsenal were playing a different tactic. It was sort of when they were experimenting with that 4-4-2. And at the time, Albert Zambi-Lokonga was playing a lot deeper and was sort of covering for Nuno when he went forward. This time, things have changed. Arsenal now play a very sort of Pep Guardiola-style 4-3-3. And instead of having a left-sided central midfielder who can sort of just drop in and cover the left-back, both their midfielders are encouraged to get forward. And it's been Thomas Partey just on his own in that single pivot, which means that with Cedric getting forward on the right, the left-back, who previously has obviously been Kieran Tierney, is then obviously asked to do a lot of defending. And that's not Nuno's game. He's never been a great defender. He's not the most switched-on guy in the world when it comes to marking people, tracking runs, that kind of stuff, positioning. So unless Arsenal look to tweak their system, I think they might have to look at someone else at left back. There are options. You can put Cedric over to left back. You can drop Granit Xhaka into left back. I've even heard people suggest Bukayo Saka playing at left back. Personally, I wouldn't do any of those. I would keep Nuno in the side, but I would change things, especially in the midfield. Thomas Partey, he may be fit for this game against Brighton. We're not 100% certain. We'll find out a bit more in the press conference tomorrow. But if he is fit, then I'd play him in a double pivot alongside Granit Xhaka and having Granit Xhaka just dropping into that sort of left-sided defensive half space where he spent a lot of time and just giving Nuno license to go forward because you're going to have to adapt the way this Arsenal side plays. They've had an attacking bias from the right-hand side. That's going to have to change. And that's just the way it is. If they want to come top four, they're going to have to adapt. It's obviously a massive blow losing someone as big as Kieran Tierney. He's their vice-captain. He's probably one of their best defenders, one of their better players this season. So it's going to be tough. Last season, losing him really threw their season off the rails in terms of the Europa League. And I think they'll be hopeful that it doesn't happen again this time around.
Yeah, don't put Saka left back, please. Please. No. Don't. He's too... He's beyond that now, please.
He's wasted. He's wasted.
I agree. He's also Arsenal's top scorer this season, so I definitely wouldn't put him at left back.
Before we move on to Southampton, give us your prediction on this. A Tierney-less Arsenal at home to Brighton.
Sorry, you have to put the reins on me when I start talking about Arsenal. I'll go a bit over the top. But I'm going to still go for a 2-0 win for Arsenal, despite all the problems they're having. I think Brighton is probably the best team in the league you could play right now if you want to get an easy win under your belt and sort of get back on the horse. So, yeah, I'm going to go 2-0 to the Arsenal.
Right, we're going to flick across and keep powering on with the Saturday games. Mo, Southampton are home to Chelsea. We actually did a video earlier on this season of how to score against Chelsea. Brentford might have watched it. Karen Benzema definitely watched it. Thanks very much, Karen, for checking that out. Not to be educated on how to score goals, lest we educate Karen Benzema. But Chelsea have got issues, Mo. They are struggling to keep clean sheets. They're struggling to not make mistakes at the back. And Brentford exposed that big time last weekend. Southampton are one of the few teams that will play with two strikers. They will look to go full throttle. And this could cause big, big problems for Chelsea.
I mean, Benzema definitely watched our video. Because if you look at that third goal, that's exactly what I said to do, is press Rudiger and Mendy when they're in possession and you can get results. And look what happened, right? So Benzema definitely watched. Brentford was different. Brentford just counterattacked Chelsea to death. The Chelsea's transition defence was awful. I don't know what happened to them in transition against Brentford. It was just... they just capitulated. They were not existent. And I just think, yeah, like Southampton, that plays perfectly into Southampton's strengths. However, Thomas Tuchel is not this, you know, he knows how serious this is. He said it after the Real Madrid game. We have to recover our level. We're nowhere near our level. So I think this is going to be a serious back to basics, like really grind it out defensive. Chelsea are going to come here, like shut up shop. They're not going to give anything away. I think they'll score one goal, but I do think they'll score one goal. They'll go up 1-0, but I think their eyes are going to be on Madrid. And last 20 minutes, I think they'll get caught out. I think 1-1, but Chelsea are going to get back to basics.
Someone that definitely needs to get back to basics is anybody down in the relegation battle, Kaya. Watford at home to Leeds this weekend. Maybe slightly unfairly, we've written Watford off and saying that themselves and Norwich are probably already down. Leeds find themselves in a position where they have to wait. They've played more games than anyone down in the relegation battle. 31 games, 30 points on the board. They're still waiting to see what happens with Everton, what happens with Burnley, before knowing what their own picture is. But they've got an opportunity this weekend to go to Watford, maybe drive another nail in their Premier League coffin, bring themselves up to 33 points, which you would say, based on this new average of 36 to 37 points, would put them in striking distance of making it a two-horse race to get relegated between Everton and Burnley.
Yeah, I think Watford possibly can catch Burnley. I think Everton's situation and the amount of points they've dropped really has brought a lot of teams who previously looked cut adrift back into it. And obviously, I think Roy Hodgson has been pitching in training, putting some lovely balls over the top for the attacking during training. So I think if they can get him in the side doing that, then why not? Unfortunately, though, he can't play for them. And for that reason, I think Leeds probably will have enough in this game. I think they're starting to look a little bit better under Jesse Marsh. They're sort of developing a little bit more of a style and seems to be responding well to his methods. So Watford are a good team defensively, but Leeds are going to go sort of with their attacking style. And I think that's just going to about win out on the day. It'll be a tight one. I think it'll be a really good game, actually. But I think Leeds will come away with a 2-1 victory, which will probably be enough to unofficially relegate Watford and probably just about keep Leeds safe as well.
Okay, fair enough. It's still such a tight picture down the bottom in terms of who's going to be relegated, but I think we could see a bit of a bolt in either direction this weekend. Watford Leeds is going to be a big one in deciding who is playing Premier League football next season. Final game of Saturday, Mo, is Aston Villa at home to Tottenham. And I want to focus on Tottenham and particularly their front three, their all power in all guns blazing front three of Harry Kane, Song Heung-min and Dejan Kulusevski. Now, we've been working on some flashy, fancy names for them. SKS, Son Kane-Sevski, etc. They're all terrible. But what is not terrible is these three guys together. They've been absolutely on fire in recent weeks. Tottenham have got 17 goals in their last five Premier League games and eight of them have been scored by at least one of these, with 60% of those goals assisted by one of their mates knocking a ball in for them. So what I want to look at is, in comparison to the teams above them, Manchester City and Liverpool, obviously there's so much focus on them this weekend. But Son, Kane and Kulusevski up against Liverpool's front three, whether that's Salah, Mane and Jota or Salah, Mane and Luis Diaz. These three are close. Are they the best front three outside of Liverpool?
They're the best front three, full stop, because this is a front three. This is these three guys and they play together and they are symbiotic and their games work better. I mean, look, Kane and Son is the greatest partnership in Premier League history. 39 goals between them, direct goals, linked goals or assists between the two pair of them. Kulusevski fits them like a hand in a glove, right? Since the start of 2022, all three of them combined have got 14 Premier League goals and 14 Premier League assists. They're perfect. Whereas Liverpool are in a state of flux because it's not Firmino, Salah and Mane anymore. But it's not also Jota, Mane and Salah. Now Luis Diaz comes into the mix. So Liverpool's front three don't have a set front three anymore. They have a squad and they rotate. But Spurs, it's these three guys. And these three guys are perfectly in sync with each other. And so, yeah, this is the best front three in the league. I like Villa a lot, actually, under Steven Gerrard. I think they've had a bit of a... They're due to score some goals again. Right? They scored 7 goals in 2 games and then scored like 2 goals in the last 3 games. So they're due to have a goal explosion again. But I just think Spurs are too good right now. This is the thing with Conte. As soon as they bottomed out of the Conference League, without even having to lose a game, by the way, that was very clever from Daniel Levy. As soon as they did that, that was it. You knew they were going to rock out the lead because Conte, as we saw with Chelsea 2016-17, when you give this guy a week in between games, no European football, which he sucks at, by the way, he's terrible at European football. If you give this guy no European football, just a week to train and hammer his players in fitness and tactical shape and discipline and everything like that. They're amazing. He turned Chelsea into one of the most dominant teams ever, basically like this, right? Overnight, right? And Spurs have got these two amazing world-class forwards. Kulusevski is really, really promising, potentially world-class as well. They've got great players basically everywhere except in goal and at fullback. And at fullback doesn't even matter because Conte's best when he has rubbish fullbacks. He makes them into great fullbacks, right? And then in goal, Hugo Lloris, he's still Hugo Lloris, even though he's quite clearly a fading force. They're really good, Spurs. They're really good. They're on the march. They're going to finish. Look, Arsenal have the game in hand, but, you know, it's Chelsea waning as well. So, I mean, don't rule out Spurs finishing top four, even though I think Arsenal still have the edge because they have the game in hand. They're definitely going to win today, though. I think they'll win 4-2. At the weekend, they'll win 4-2, I think.
Okay, right. That wraps up Saturday's action. So we're going to move on to Sunday. Brentford at home to West Ham. Kaya, London derby. Brentford probably in that group of teams that are just on the right side of safety. Still a bit of work to do. West Ham pushing in Europe. They'll be playing midweek in the Europa League and obviously still have designs on top four, maybe top six to get themselves in the Europa League next season. How do you see this going down?
I think West Ham are probably going to suffer a post-Europa League hangover. I think they're really going to go for it on Thursday night against Lyon, or this evening as we're recording it. And I think, they should go for it. It's probably one of the biggest games in their history, this European quarterfinal. I think they have a decent chance, actually, of beating Lyon across two legs. So the squad depth isn't that great. And I can't see David Moyes making too many sort of full, like, 11-style changes across the two games, as we've seen previous teams in Europe do. That said, I think they'll go all out on Thursday night. I think they'll take it a little bit easier on Sunday and prepare themselves for the second leg, because I don't think that game's going to be done in the first leg. So I think Brentford, off the back of that win over Chelsea last week, they're looking in good form. Christian Eriksen's playing really well. He's been a really good addition to their side. I'm gonna back them for a 1-0 victory, and I think probably West Ham, in losing this game, will rule themselves out of the top four race. But I think they're definitely in it for top six, maybe even top seven, if United can't sort of get their act together.
Moving on, Leicester City against Crystal Palace. Mo, I'm going to go to you first on this because Jeff Schlupp is on my mind, and I'm labelling this one the Jeff Schlupp derby because I really like Jeff Schlupp. He's a really important player for Palace. Patrick Vieira's probably got another level out of him that maybe under Roy Hodgson we didn't see. And he's genuinely in that block of players that are so, so underrated within the Premier League. He doesn't make a lot of top 10 lists. He definitely doesn't make a lot of combined 11s or fantasy football picks. But he's a really good Premier League player, coach's dream, all the other cliches that you could throw around. So this has actually got me thinking about who are the most underrated players in the Premier League. Jeff Schlupp is definitely one of them. Crystal Palace fans love him. Patrick Vieira is a big fan of him. Spoke glowingly about him on Monday night. Who is your most underrated player in the Premier League? Everybody loves to have a player that they keep in the pocket and they can just roll out and impress everybody because nobody ever thought of it. And we know that you love doing that. So go on. Who's your most underrated player in the Premier League?
All right, before we get to that, just one second. When you mentioned that Hodgson pass earlier, I'm so associated Hodgson with Palace now. I was thinking, oh yeah, Michael Olyse. That's why he learned to do that. But of course, Hodgson was never at Palace when Michael Olyse was. It was just... with regards to Palace, I think they'll be too good for Leicester. I think Leicester will have a Conference League a bit of a hangover. I think Palace showed against Arsenal they're a very, very good team. They're in great form, to be honest. They've really been playing well lately. Vieira's got them humming. Zaha will be fully fit. I don't think he was fully fit against Arsenal. They have Olise back. He wasn't. Didn't make the Arsenal game. And they'll have Jeffrey Schlupp, you know, who's playing really well too. So I think. They'll have 2-1. They'll win 3-1. As for the most underrated player in the Premier League, look, I'll tell you who it is, mate. It's Bruno Fernandes, the one everyone says is having a rubbish season. Yeah, he's got 6 XA, expected assists this season. That's second in the Premier League. He's created 14 big chances. That's joint third. He's created 77 chances overall. That's top. He's played 20 through balls. That's top as well, right? He's been not quite at his brilliant best, but he's been still a fantastic player. And everyone's saying he's having a rubbish season because he's passing to a bunch of idiots who can't finish shots. You know, what do you want to do? The man has created 6 expected assists. He's got 14 big chances created. That's level with Mohamed Salah, just behind Harry Kane and son. He's got less assists than Lacazette. You know, does that make, you know, is that his fault? Is that somehow a deficiency on him? But if Bruno Fernandes is too, you know, Bruno Fernandes to be high rated, I'll say Rafinha. Rafinha's fantastic, magnificent winger. Never really given as much praise as he deserves because he's fantastically fun to watch. 5.44 expected assists this season, which is fourth behind Alexander-Arnold, Bruno Fernandes, and Mohamed Salah. 58 take-ons completed, which is fourth. By the way, take-ons completed, Adama Traore is still second in the Premier League. Hasn't played since, like, what, November? That's hilarious. 58 chances created for Rafinha, that's fifth. 9 big chances created as well. That's not quite that high. It's like 12th or something, but he's still doing the business. He's only got 9 goals and 3 assists because he's playing for Leeds, and Leeds, until Jesse Marsh showed up, were not having a good time. So, but yeah, Rafinha, I think, is really, really good. I think Leeds have now dipped enough, and he's still playing well enough that he's going to earn a big move in the summer. I don't know where to. Barcelona were linked, but I mean, it could be anywhere, really. He's really, really fantastic. So I would say Bruno Fernandes, with a caveat that no one's appreciating for how good he is, but if that's not allowed, then fine, Rafinha.
I am absolutely amazed that you've picked Bruno Fernandes, little-known Portuguese international, Manchester United.
Everyone says
United
he's rubbish.
Star.
Everyone's saying he's rubbish. Bruno, he's still doing the business.
Bruno Fernandes. Wow. I mean, I suppose the real big surprise is that you didn't pick Aaron Wan-Bissaka, but, you know, grateful for small mercies.
Listen. He's not having a good season. So he isn't having a good season, so I couldn't pick Wan-Bissaka.
Okay, fair enough. And as last week's podcast proved, maybe we were wrong about Aaron Wan-Bissaka all along. So, Kaya, hopefully you've understood the brief a bit more, underrated, maybe someone that isn't, you know, playing for one of the biggest teams in the country or a decorated international player.
Yeah, I'm going to go for another Man U player. I'm going to pick Cristiano Ronaldo. No, I'm joking. I'm going to go for a player from Wolves who I think has really impressed me this season. And I think he was ridiculously unfortunate not to have been in the most recent England squad, and that's Max Kilman. I think he is one of the best centre-backs in the Premier League. I think he's being linked to some of the big teams. I think a lot of the big teams are starting to take notice of him now, which is about time. Chelsea have shown interest. Apparently Manchester United have also shown interest. And he's someone who he started off his career in futsal, which means that he's really technically gifted, which is something that I don't think you necessarily... There's not that many left-footed centre-backs who are really good on the ball. And he's one of the best dribblers. I think he's up there in... I think FBref have him up there in sort of the 81st, 82nd percentile for dribbles, 86th for dribbles completed. Successful dribbles is up there in the 83rd. Doesn't get dribble passed very often as well. And so, yeah, he's a really fantastic player. I think he works well in that back three with Wolves. And I think he was to go to Chelsea. I think that would work well also. So I really like Max Kilman. I think he probably should have been in the England squad ahead of someone like a Tyrone Mings. I think he offers a lot more. Defensively really solid and also a really good player on the...
That's a good shout. You know what? When you said Wolves, I thought you were going to say Jose Sarr. Just quick shout on Jose Sarr, because he's another player who you could have for most underrated. This guy has prevented, according to Opta's data, he's prevented 9.7 goals this season. That's absurd. Like, the next highest is David De Gea on 5. And next highest after him is Alisson on 2.9. 9.7 goals. His expected goals on target conceded is 29.7. He's conceded 20 goals. Like, he's faced 123 shots and he just keeps saving them, man. He's having an outrageous season. Like, everyone was wondering, oh God, they're going to lose Rui Patricio. What are they going to do? Well, they've got someone who's better than Rui Patricio. Like, it's outrageous. I mean, I don't know if you keep this up. Obviously, it feels very unsustainable. Kind of like David De Gea's 2017-18 season where he like stopped 11 goals or whatever it was. So I don't think this is sustainable necessarily. But this season, I mean, this guy's underrated as hell. He's having an incredible year. He's been the best goalie in the Premier League.
My pick for Premier League's most underrated player, because I've looked to go along the lines of you need an underrated attribute to be a truly underrated player. You want to do the stuff that nobody else wants to do, the unglamorous stuff, the unfashionable stuff. So I've gone for Brentford's Christian Norgaard. So I'm basing this on those stats that he is top of the shop or pretty close to being top of. According to Opta, he's second for successful pressures in the Premier League, 616 so far this season. And of those that were successful in winning the ball in a progressive possession sense, he's top 194, 33% of his pressures have resulted in a successful winning of the ball. And he does exactly what he says on the tin. 60 successful tackles in the midfield third. That is nearly two-thirds more than his closest rival, which is John McGinn. If you're a ball-winning central midfielder, you need to win the ball in central midfield. And Christian Norgaard does that. So he's my pick because he does what he's told. He's a good boy. He does what's said on the tin. He wins the ball in midfield. He presses high and he allows Christian Eriksen and Ivan Toney to grab all the glory. So Christian Norgaard is my pick for most underrated in the Premier League. We're going to wrap up with the last two games. One not so exciting and one packed with excitement. Unfortunately, Kaya, we're going to give you what we think is the one that's not as exciting, and that's Norwich against Burnley. Norwich are allergic to scoring goals. They just can't seem to score goals. And we know, unfortunately, their time in the Premier League is probably done. Whereas Burnley, Sean Dyche has got a smile as wide as anything this week. They've beaten Everton. They've got themselves in touching distance of safety. And he was proved right all along by not panicking. If they win this, they could be out of the bottom three.
Yeah, we'll agree to disagree on the excitement levels of this game. I'm pretty excited about it. I think it's going to be an interesting match. I don't think it'll necessarily be the most entertaining, but in terms of the landscape at the bottom of the Premier League, I think it's quite an important one. I'm backing Burnley to win. I don't think anyone can really back Norwich to win any game of football right now, just because they can't score goals, like you said, and because they concede so many. I think Dean Smith's done a better job than Daniel Farker was doing, but it was a low bar. And Burnley looked decent on Wednesday against Everton. They, I think, are unlucky to concede both penalties. For me, both questionable penalties, and I think they could have won that game a lot more comfortably. But now they've got the momentum of that victory behind them. I'd really back them to stay up. And I think Bart Vedcourt has done pretty well. Cornet's a really good goal threat. So they've made some smart additions to their side, which is obviously previously has always been a little bit more functional. But those guys are good. And I think they will get goals against Burnley. Having said they'll get goals, I only think they'll get one come Sunday. And I think that'll be enough for them to win a 1-0 victory.
Mate, Burnley's staying up, man. Did you see Shawnee Dyche? I don't think these guys know how to win an away game. Mate, that is the energy radiating off that man could light up a city. Are you kidding me? They're going to do it again, man. Shawnee Dyche, you can only respect him. He's the Premier League Diego Simeone. He's the Premier League Diego Simeone. If you ask Diego Simeone, who's your favourite manager of the Premier League? I guarantee you he says Shawnee Dyche. Guarantee you.
Diego Simeone wears Shawnee Dyche pyjamas. I just had this image of him going into the Everton dressing room and just ruffling Frank Lampard's hair after doing that to him. But there's still a long way to go, but Burnley are moving in the right direction. Right, final game of part one and the prediction section of the podcast is the little known. No one's talking about it. No one's focusing on it. You might have even forgotten that it's going on this weekend. Manchester City hosting Liverpool. Potential title decider. The game of the year, let's be honest, this is absolutely building up to be a massive one. And one of the interesting aspects of this is that aside from the potential of Ruben Diaz not making it in time, Mo, and being fit to feature, both sides are fully fit, both managers are up for it, both teams are in fantastic form, both teams are pushing for a treble, potentially a quadruple. This is all set up to be an absolute blockbuster. Is it going to meet expectation?
No, when have these games ever met expectation? No, this is not Barcelona versus Real Madrid. This is Man City, Liverpool. These two teams are so focused on defence in their own ways. With City, it's keeping the ball. With Liverpool, it's actually having an amazing defence. There's no way this game's going to be fun. Like, Anfield was fun, right? Because Liverpool weren't quite at their best selves. And so City bodied them repeatedly. And then Liverpool still managed to score two goals. So that game was fun because Liverpool weren't quite at their best and City were a bit vulnerable at the back. The way these two teams are playing right now, this game will be awful. I mean, it'll be really good, but it won't be fun. Like, it won't be like, there won't be end-to-end action. It'll be really, really high stakes, really tense. I mean, this is game. You said it's potential title decider. This is a title decider. If City win this game, they go 4 points clear. Liverpool got much harder running. It's over. If Liverpool win this game, having come back from what, 14 points was the gap at one point, City are going to crumble. Forget about it. Like, Liverpool will feel invincible. We've seen before, when Liverpool do impossible things, or seemingly impossible things, it gives them a feeling of invincibility. When they beat Barcelona 4-0 at Anfield without Mohamed Salah or Sadio Mane, everyone was like, what? That's not possible. And they did it, right? And then after that, look at the run they went on the Premier League. I think they drew one game against Man United and that was it. They won like the other 27 games. That's absurd. When they get the feeling they're invincible, they become invincible, right? So Liverpool come from 14 points back to take the lead and go top of the Premier League. They're going to run away with it. Forget it. They'll win every single game the rest of the season. And that'll be it. So whoever wins this game wins the title. It's that simple. To me, it's going to be great to watch. It'll be so involving. It won't be fun. But then it's the same thing. What do you define fun? I thought Man City, Atletico Madrid was amazing. I loved it. People were saying, oh, it was boring, it wasn't exciting. I thought it was great watching City play. City played the most outrageously good game of football I've seen in a long time. And then they won 1-0. And they didn't really create loads of chances either. But the way they dominated and pinned Atletico in was just obscene. They're so good. They're so good, it's ridiculous. Like, Joao Cancelo was playing these passes. And I was like, how are you playing these? The passes weren't even leading to anything, not like shots or anything. I was just like, these passes are incredible. If Erling Haaland played for Man City, or Harry Kane had gone to Man City, he would have scored 4 or 5 goals in that game. That's how many chances City created, good chances for a striker. But in the end, they didn't even have shots off them. without a striker. And Liverpool, like Liverpool are such a good team at just winning games, right? They're just so good at it. They can sit deep. Their midfield works hard. And this is what I'm saying. It's going to come down to midfield battle, right? That's what it's going to come down to ultimately. Because City have the dominance in midfield. They have the midfield three, and they have João Cancelo playing midfield. They have Kyle Walker playing midfield. Bernardo Silva drops back playing midfield. So there's basically 5-6 guys in there all at one time. There's always three guys in there, basically, at minimum, right? There's always three guys in there, whether it's always Rodri, and then sometimes it's defensive midfielders, sometimes it's the wingers, sometimes it's whoever. There's always three guys in there. They always have control of that midfield part. Liverpool's midfield is different, right? Liverpool can defend, knuckle down, and hit on the break. It's going to be interesting to see what Klopp does here, because this is previously he's always tended to sort of drop Thiago out and bring in a worker, Curtis Jones at Anfield in the last game, you know, Milner sometimes in big games this season, and he goes full workhorse in midfield. But Thiago is playing quite well right now. Liverpool are doing quite well with Thiago, playing progressively, and he can defend as well. He's a good defender. And he knows Pep as well. He knows Pep's teams. So if Klopp really goes for it and tries to actually engage Liverpool in a game of football, it sounds weird to say, but I think it might actually work out better for him, just in the sense that there's no way City are expecting that. City are expecting Liverpool to come in, hunker down deep and try and break in behind with that amazing front three running into spaces, which, by the way, it's also a very viable strategy for City, especially if, as you say, Ruben Dias isn't going to play. Because João Cancelo, as we saw at Anfield, João Cancelo bossed that game, but Salah did him twice for both Liverpool goals, like completely stitched him up. So he's not the greatest defender in the universe. But, you know, it's such a great game. It's such a massive, tense game. The key is that obviously the midfield battle is key. That's one thing. Is Jota going to start? I imagine he is. Michael Owen made that prediction based on the fact that Salah and Mane went off midweek that Jota's going to start. I mean, probably a good shout. But Firmino could give Liverpool a bit of extra control, a bit of extra pressing if they want it. I don't know. But the other key, the final key is Phil Foden, right? I mean, BT went a bit nuts with their praise of him. Like, that's saying he's going to become the most decorated English player ever. Like, Paul Scholes has won like 10 Premier League titles. It's going to take a bit to go ahead of that. Don't get me wrong, but he's already got like three, right? So, and he's only 21. So it is possible, to be fair, but Guardiola would have to stay at Man City, I would feel. But Foden is great, and he's an X factor, and he does well against Liverpool in particular, right? Like, early in the game this season, he had, 49 touches, 8 crosses, 8 touches in the opposition box, 7 passes into the box, 5 ball recoveries, 2 shots, 1 goal, which was against the equaliser. And then he basically created the second equaliser as well with that cross, which was deflected into De Bruyne's path. He was a menace that game. And I know he was playing Milner and not Trent, but Trent isn't a great defender anyway. And as Gabriel Martinelli showed recently, if you just keep running at Trent, not even that he will necessarily fold, he might even do well, but he will be too occupied defending you to actually go up the other end and hurt you. That's why Liverpool did so well against Arsenal, because they just kept Trent busy defending the whole game. And so he couldn't get forward in attack. And as we've seen recently, without Trent, Liverpool are about half as good, you know, in terms of attack, because he's so important to their... I mean, I talked about Bruno and Fernandes' expected assists out of the season. Trent's got like 10 plus expected assists, more than double, almost double the next guy. Trent's a phenomenon, right? So keeping him occupied defending is a huge thing. That's why I think Foden is so key. But I think what they'll do is they'll put him wide, like they did at Anfield, they'll put him wide left in the Sané position, and they'll just say, look, keep going at him. Just run at him all game long. Stay wide, hold him wide, and run at him. And keep looking for Foden. Keep looking for Foden. Cancelo will tuck in, play in midfield. He'll even play De Bruyne on the left instead of the right and push De Bruyne up into that space around. Basically, they'll try and gang up on Trent. And on the right, they'll just keep control and keep it safe and keep an eye on Robertson and his overlapping runs. Liverpool's whole game plan has to be to release Salah, Mane and Jota on the break. And they can do that. They can do that in a heartbeat, especially with the likes of Henderson, who's got great long-range passing. Fabinho's got long-range passing. Thiago is obviously excellent. You know, it's such a high-stakes game. It's almost impossible to call. But if I had to make a prediction, I would say City would just have too much, because Liverpool don't have a good record at the Etihad. They haven't won a league match at the Etihad since 2015-16. That was pre-Guardiola. They tend to lose there, or at best they get a draw. I would say it's probably going to be 1-0 City. But it's going to be really tense and really fun to watch. If you like watching tactical battles, it's not going to be a lot of end-to-end action. I don't think so. I mean, who knows? The last one was 2-2. But I would imagine it's been very tight, very tense. So keep an eye on it, watch it, but don't expect that it's going to blow your socks off.
It's going to be absolutely massive. Before we do take a break, Kai, I'm just going to quickly throw it across to you. Give us a quick prediction. And would you agree with Mo that if City win, that's the title race done?
I I think I would, just about. It's really difficult to say because Liverpool have already come back from such a massive deficit. I don't think they've left themselves. I don't think there will be enough time if they lose this weekend. That said, I don't know if they will. I think it'll probably be a draw. I think both teams will probably cancel each other out. I think both teams will be so afraid to lose this game that we'll probably end up with a 0-0 of the type that a couple of years ago when Riyad Mahrez blazed over a penalty in the last minute. I think it could be one of those kind of games. It could be really tight, and then sort of both teams will take that and go into the rest of the season. I think the more exciting of these two Man City Liverpool games is probably going to be the FA Cup semi-final.
From the thrills and spills of a 1-0 to the excitement of a 0-0. Right, we are going to take a quick break on the Squawker Talker podcast. After the break, we're continuing the Manchester City Liverpool theme, but Manchester United fans, Arsenal fans, you're more than welcome to come and join the party because we are comparing the greatest Premier League teams and asking the big question: is Pep versus Klopp, Liverpool versus Manchester City, the greatest ever Premier League rivalry? That's what we're getting stuck into in part two, and we'll be back in just a sec. Welcome back to the Squawker Talker podcast. And obviously all the attention this weekend is on Manchester City against Liverpool. So in part two of the show, we are keeping up the narrative and we are talking Pep City and Klopp's Liverpool and where they rank in the all-time Premier League rivalry stakes. Now, as Arsenal fans, as Manchester United fans on the podcast today, this is a bit of a sore subject because we grew up with iconic teams, iconic players, Ferguson against Wenger, Keane against Vieira, Thierry Henry. I'm sure Manchester United have a few world-class players that Mo mentioned, but, you know, I like to just throw Thierry Henry in there. This is massive. This is a massive rivalry between Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp on a personal level, a tactical level, the two sets of fans, the two teams. And it's all powered by success. Any great rivalry at the top of the Premier League is powered by success. You're successful. Your rival is successful. They win a trophy. You win a trophy. You challenge each other. You drive each other on. And there's no doubt that that is the case for City and Liverpool. Pep Guardiola has said this a number of times, that Manchester City are so good and so dominant because of Liverpool, because Liverpool are there every season. And that has been the case this season as well. And that is the case in the title race. But this is a very emotional and narrative-filled argument, Mo. So I want to go to you first on this, because the way that we've measured this, and we're definitely going to offend some people, probably Chelsea fans, but we've tried to be as tight as we can as possible when judging rivalries. And it has to be Manchester United, Arsenal. So we've chopped it into two blocks to kind of measure the rivalry. And that was 1998 until 2001, and then 2001 until 2003 for both Arsenal and Manchester United. It was an unbelievable rivalry, Mo. Do you think this now even touches the surface?
You know, with my head, yes. With my heart, no, absolutely not. Are you kidding me? This is these two managers like each other. That's the first thing off. You can't have a rivalry. They like each other. They respect each other. They're immensely proud of each other. Like, yeah, Liverpool are great. Yeah, City are brilliant. They're so good. You can't say that about your opponent. What's wrong with you? This is also me revealing my age, right? Because I think if you're 30 or over, it's not going to be the same for you, right? Because it's like, you, first of all, you didn't grow up with it, and secondly, in your memory, the rivalry of United was so much more intense. By the way, Chelsea fans, just quick shout out to you guys. Look, you have a rival, you have a beef with basically everyone in the league, but you're no one's biggest rival except for like Palace. And with all due respect, Palace. That's the problem Chelsea have, right? They're nobody's biggest rival. They're everyone's second or third biggest rival, right? Mourinho tried desperately and did, to be fair, make them into a major player in the Premier League. Fair play. Roman Abramovich with his questionable sources of income. Made them into a major force in the Premier League. Fair play. But there was no local rival that wasn't already taken, you know? You can't have Arsenal. She's Man United's girl, sort of thing. And then Chelsea and Liverpool. That was the closest we got, Chelsea versus Liverpool. But that was more a rivalry in Europe because it wasn't in they weren't contending for the league against each other. So, yeah. So, respect to Chelsea fans because they have been great over the last 20 years. Look, Man United Arsenal, this was a rivalry in the very sort of old school toxic masculine sense of rivalry, where these were just two groups of men that hated each other, like, and just were just like ridiculously contemptuous of each other. to a degree that is was completely unhealthy, and I'm glad it's gone. But oh my God, it was so good when it was there. But it's wrong, kids. It's really bad. You shouldn't behave like this. And it's really better that football isn't like that anymore. But looking back at it nostalgically, I can be like, that was flipping great, wasn't it? That was wonderful. Keane and Vieira hated each other. And it was great. And they were so excellent as well. It's the two world-class players that genuinely just didn't like each other and were open about and like each other. I mean, Roy Keane in the Highbury Tunnel is still, for me, the greatest moment in Premier League history. It's not even on the pitch. It's the greatest moment in Premier League history. It was just absolutely incredible. And that game, by the way, is still also, for me, the greatest game in Premier League history. May 92, Arsenal 4. Arsenal 2, May 94, sorry. Absolutely had everything that game. Just pure drama. Amazing. I don't think a single one of the goals was bad. They were all amazing, or at least hilarious. Like the United goal when Almunia ran out and Giggs lobbed it over him and Ronaldo taps in. Fantastic game. Really, really great game. Everything that rivalry was about. Just bitterness, anger. You know, Martin Keown jumping all over Ruben Nistelrooy when he scored Ultra. That made me so angry when I was younger. I was like, how dare you, Martin Keown? Like, you know, it was like the most offensive thing in the world to me. And I was like, no, hang on, it's not really. It's just a football match. Calm down. But that rivalry was just so ferocious. You know, United would look like the dominant team in the world. They had little rivalries with Blackburn, you know, Norwich to a degree. And then, but then they were cruising it. And then Arsenal comes along and Fergie was so rude about Arsene Wenger. Like, so dismissive of this guy who's in Japan. What does he know about football? Get out of here, you weirdo. And then Wenger, like, wins the title in his first full season. Like, wins the double, in fact. Like, has Arsenal, transforms Arsenal. Brilliant signings as well. Some great players, Marco Overmars, Patrick Vieira, you know, Nicolas Anelka. Really, really good signings. Really, like, who are these guys? These unknown gems. Because, you know, Wenger introduced the concept of actually scouting outside of England. It was amazing. What a concept. So he put unearthed these gems that were actually just really good players. Anyway, fantastic, right? Arsenal won the double. United had their pants pulled down. That guy in the leather jacket with the curly hair doing the what is he up to these days? I want to know what that guy's doing with the scarf. Remember him, the iconic guy from the Overmars.
Yeah.
What's he doing these days? I mean, I want to know what that guy is. If you're listening, that guy, message me on Twitter. You know where I'm at, Mohammed Butt. Just give me a shout. I want to hear from you. Great stuff. And then United respond, winning the treble. It's like, oh, we need to do something. Winning the treble. I recently saw a Liverpool fan say that Liverpool, if they win the treble, will be much more impressive than Man United because of the level of opposition faced, talking about how great City are. And that's fair. City are great. But Arsenal, like, and I was like, you must be a Spurs fan because Arsenal that season conceded 17 goals in the league. 17. And they'd lost the title. That's ridiculous. That team was so good, the Arsenal 98-99 team, and they just fell out. They just lost out in the FA Cup, in one of the greatest FA Cup games of all time, and in the league, literally on the last day of the season, you know, having conceded 17 goals all campaign. Ridiculous rivalry and then United took the advantage from there, right? After the treble, United took put their foot down a little bit, but Wenger wasn't done. Wenger wasn't done.
What Mo is saying, I do agree with, and is this your take on it as well, that the change in perceptions of what a rivalry is at the top end of the Premier League table, the biggest difference between these two rivalries, Manchester United against Arsenal and now Manchester City and Liverpool, in that United-Arsenal, we associate it with Keane and Vieira in the tunnel, Pizzagate, Fergie and Wenger arguing, battles on the pitch, Van Nistelrooy and Keown, Ian Wright and Peter Schmeichel, there's just incident after incident after incident and flashpoints. That doesn't happen in these games. I'm just looking back through previous fixtures, and this will make Roy Keane really angry. There's only ever been one player sent off in a City-Liverpool game since Klopp and Guardiola came in. Roy Keane must be seething about that. But have we all just grown up? Has Premier League football just grown up? And now instead of throwing fists at each other or slices of pizza, we're throwing numbers at each other? Because the data doesn't lie in terms of the rivalry and what has happened between them, because that iconic season in 2018-19 where they went pound for pound against each other, there was just a point between them, could well end this season with just a point between them. And some of the numbers that they've racked up are just better. Even finishing second in that season has outstripped United and Arsenal in almost every campaign they've ever played in the Premier League.
I don't know quite if the Premier League's grown up. I think there's a lot of teams that still hate each other. They're just not Manchester City and Liverpool. I think I wouldn't describe their rivalry as a sort of a rivalry by dictionary definition. For me, it's more like competition between the two. It's more healthy. It's more friendly. Whereas a rivalry sort of implies a bit more animosity. If you look at it now, like, just the teams aren't as divided. Back in the back in the day. I say back in the day. I was like six when the Invincibles happened. So this is sort of previous, a little bit before my time. But back in the day, when I was walking around in nappies, the Arsenal and Manchester United teams, when they went off on international duty, when they went to those England golden generation England squads, you'd hear about how they wouldn't even sit with each other then. They really didn't like each other as players, whereas these Man City and Liverpool guys, they respect each other. They sort of can separate the on-field from the off-field. And there's not as many flashpoints. There's not as many individual battles. I look at someone like, I don't know, Trent Alexander-Arnold versus Kyle Walker. Both two great right-backs, both two very different right-backs, both obviously English and going for that same spot. They should really be a lot more individually sort of hateful towards one another, but they're not. And that's because the rivalry's not really been whipped up in the same way. It's not quite as aggressive a rivalry. So I think Man City and Liverpool, in terms of an actual Premier League rivalry, aren't sort of comparable to Manchester United and Arsenal from sort of 90s, noughties. But I think in terms of quality, you could definitely make an argument that sort of the way the game's tactically evolved, the way players are now in terms of nutrition, physicality, fitness, all those kind of things, then yeah, it'd be interesting to see how those Manchester United and Arsenal teams would sort of cope in the Premier League today and sort of whether that style of rivalry would be welcomed as much. I think it'd be an interesting sort of experiment if it were possible. But unfortunately, I guess we'll never be able to compare them directly. But if you're looking at rivalries by the dictionary definition, as an Arsenal fan, you're not really going to go too much further beyond Arsenal versus Manchester United.
I mean, look, you look at the Rob Brown once said on Twitter, very controversially, as he loves to do, that if Man United in 1999 came into the modern Premier League, they'd just be Burnley. And I was like, how dare you? And I thought about it, I was like, well, maybe. I mean, not literally. They have better players than Burnley did, but essentially the way they played was like Burnley. It was 4-4-2, four strikers, get the ball wide, play aggressively, play quick. And you think even Arsenal back then, again, everyone associates Arsene Wenger with Barcelona-style passing football, which that was his late era. The early Arsenal team was ferociously quick. They played 4-4-2, first of all, two wingers. One of them was usually cut inside.
It was catch me if you can football.
Yeah, I mean, Wenger's first, if you look at his original team, he had one defensive midfielder, which is Petit, right? Or Gilberto sometimes. Vieira then was the other guy. He had one winger, who was like a winger. And then he had one winger who would cut inside a bit more. Not like in field, but like make diagonal runs into the box almost. Like, so it was Ray Parlour, it was Freddie Ljungberg, right? And then he had Overmars and the appearance. So, you know, Wenger's football was very direct. It was very cutting. If you look at the early Arsenal goals, it's remarkable how quickly they go bam, back from back to front. A really good example is watch the video compilation of Thierry Henry's all his Arsenal goals. First of all, just a treat because they're all great and he's a great footballer.
You're implying I haven't done it already.
No, I'm sure we've all watched it multiple times. That I think Thierry Henry is the greatest player of the Premier League of all time, along with Roy Keane. And Thierry Henry never even retained the title, which for me is the barometer of greatness. Like, if you want to be one of the greatest ever, retain the title. So you have to understand that's how good Henry was. You know, like Henry was like Salah 2017-18, but like for four seasons in a row. So think about that, kids. So yeah, if you go and watch that video, right, you see the progression, because the first goals, it's like Vieira ping over the top and Henry's gone like a bolt of lightning and they can't catch him. And so Arsene Wenger played very direct football at the beginning and then he evolved because he was like, okay, Henry's getting a bit old, he's got back problems, Vieira's leaving, I need to build a new team. Who do I build around? He picked Cesc, and that redefined everything. And that, coupled with the Paris defeat in the Champions League final, where he sort of sacrificed his principles to get to that final and went very defensive and counter-attacky, and then didn't win. I thought he became just a full-on idealist. It was like, I'm not never doing that again. never sacrifice my principles again. So he became a full-on idealist, which is always counterproductive in football. You need to have a degree of pragmatism, as Guardiola has shown in the rubber against Liverpool. So Guardiola's idealism. Like, he'd have midfield, like, it was mostly with Bayern, was his mostly idealistic phase, right? And his last season at Barca, midfielders in defence, defenders in defensive midfielders, just doing all kinds of ridiculous nonsense. Thomas Müller in central midfield, like, because he was like, I can do this. This team is good enough to do this. And at Man City, he's come and he got a bit of a rude awakening that first season in the Premier League, and he was like, have to be a bit more pragmatic, a little bit more. So he's got Kyle Walker, who's primarily a defensive player, right, in playing right back, a defensive shield at right back. He played Fernandinho for the longest time. Fernandinho is much better at defending than attacking. Not that he's bad at attacking, but he's a primarily cynical player. I mean, his cynical fouls on the break became a legendary thing for City. You know, David Silva, great footballer, very cynical player, loves a little dirty foul. So City, he's embraced the darker side of it, right? Whereas Wenger didn't in the latter stages, which is why there's not much of a rivalry between United and Wenger in those latter stages, because Wenger became a full idealist, which made him very easy for Fergie to pick on. But when Wenger was sharp and really at it and were willing to get down and mix it down and get down and dirty, basically when he had some remnants of George Graham's team, like, it all changed after the Invincibles, because Martin Keown left and Ray Parlour left and Sylvain Wiltord left. And they were, for me, they were Arsenal's three most ferocious players in terms of fighters. And so Arsenal lost a bit of fight. But that's just it, man. Arsenal, see, this is the thing. Arsenal, Man United, for me, you talk about it and it's like the iconic matches just over and over again. Loads of great moments. And it is like you said, Kaya, a rivalry implies a bit of animosity. And they didn't like each other. They didn't like each other. And United and Arsenal fans still, to this day, rinse each other on Twitter. Even though both clubs have basically been a joke for like 5-6 years. Like, not serious, but they still treat each other as the most serious opponents, serious rivals. United fans never get more agitated than when Arsenal are doing well, maybe when Liverpool are doing well, to be fair. But, you know, it's there's real animosity there. Whereas with City, Liverpool's biggest rival is Man United. They don't really care about City in that way. And City's biggest rival is also Man United. So they can't really bring themselves to care about Liverpool in that way. And so it's, like you said, it's much more professional. It's like, this is the best team in the world. No, this is the best team in the world. Now they're facing each other. Who's going to win? You know what I mean? Like, I mean, look at the numbers, right? Since 2018-19, Man City have won 338 points in the Premier League. Liverpool have won 337. You know, City have lost 22 games. Liverpool have lost 15. They've only lost 15 games. City have dropped 31 points from winning positions. Liverpool have only dropped 36. But this is where the style difference comes in, by the way. This is a great little stat. City have only gained 27 points from losing positions, right, in this run. Liverpool have gained 63. So that just goes to show you the difference there. City are just a dominant team. They just beat you repeatedly. Liverpool might give you a chance, but they'll beat you in the end as well, because they're ferocious, they're relentless, they don't stop coming. They're like the Terminator. They just don't stop.
Okay, and it pains me to say this, and I'm sure it pains you to say it or hear it as an Arsenal fan as well, but is that part of the reason why we're having this conversation about Manchester City and Liverpool rivaling the rivalry of Arsenal and Manchester United, in that Arsenal burnt brightly, but too briefly? We're talking about these two spells where they challenge United, the 1998 double, the Invincibles, which I haven't even included in this bracket because United didn't even have the good manners to finish second and put a bit of pressure on Arsenal. This has been the situation from 2018-19 up until the present day. These two teams have been on at each other. Pep's been on at Klopp, the players there every step of the way. And no, we don't have these moments like Keane and Vieira. We don't see Jordan Henderson and Kevin De Bruyne tussling in the tunnel and people kicking lumps out of each other during games and getting sent off and fined and all the rest of it. But that has been the changing dynamic of it. But I don't think we can really argue with this idea that this has been the most consistent two teams dominating each other, as much as I'd like to say it. But Arsenal never rivaled United in the way that City rival Liverpool or Liverpool rival City.
It's tricky because you talk about consistency and then you say I'm not allowed to mention the Invincibles. So my main counterpoint has been taken away from me. I've been swept from under my feet.
I think you can mention
you can,
them.
But it's United.
United were the reason the Invincibles happened. They messed up at Old Trafford and then United ended the Invincibles. So the Invincibles, it's still tied up in United. United just bottled it against everyone else, didn't finish second.
Yeah, okay. Well, then I'll mention the Invincibles. Consistency-wise, Arsenal, it's not like Arsenal and Manchester United were sort of miles off each other in the interceding seasons between, obviously, the 98 and the 2002 double-winning sides for Arsenal. They were always very close, and they did always run each other close. I think the only real... We've not had a sort of an out-and-out title race between Manchester City and Liverpool for a little while. So I think, obviously, there was that season where they both got 90 plus points, but the season Liverpool won the league, Man City were a long way off. Last season Liverpool came third, so maybe it's not quite as clear cut in terms of the two sides pushing each other all the way to the end as it might seem. I think maybe that 90 point season does cloud us a little bit. Having said that, I do think that Liverpool, Manchester City, in terms of those sort of criteria that you mentioned there of pushing each other to the limit, I think they probably just about edge it. But I don't think it's quite as much, by quite as much of a distance as it might seem, just by sort of perception of how close this rivalry has been. Because over the past couple of years, it's not actually been that close. So this season is sort of, it's really come back to the fore of things. But let's not forget, I mean, Chelsea were title contenders at the start of this season as well, so it almost looked like a three-way thing. But I think probably Liverpool, Man City just about edgy on that one, but not by as much as it might seem.
Chelsea have form for that, by the way. Just not to dig on Chelsea fans even more, but in the 1998-99 season, the fabled 1999, Chelsea were in the title race until like spring. They were there. They fell off at the end, but they were involved. So Chelsea being involved is nothing new. Look, you know what? You say that, Virgil, you say that Arsenal never really matched Man United. And okay, yeah, I agree. They didn't really retain the title. And 2001 was a blowout season. Arsenal weren't even close to United, right? United beat them 6-1 or wherever it was, right? So yeah, fine. But you know what? If Liverpool don't win the title this season, right? That's the last, 5 years? City won 4 titles, Liverpool won 1. Have Liverpool matched Man City? Have they? Like, they've come close, sure. Closer maybe than Arsenal did to United a bunch of times. But this is why actually this weekend's match is so huge for me, right? Because this almost decides if it's a rivalry or not, like a true rivalry. Because if City win, and I think they've got an easier run in, I think they probably will, and then they'll go on and win the title. Then that's what? That's two titles, 17, 18, 19, 19. They blipped one season, 2021, 21, 22. That's 4 titles in 5 years they've won, with Liverpool winning in the middle. Now, Liverpool's title win was very impressive. I'm not taking it away from them. It was fantastic. They were great. But one title win in 4 years, that's not a rivalry. Not if there's not one pre-existing. Like, okay, fine. Real Madrid, Barcelona. Real Madrid won one title in like 4 or 5 years against Barcelona. During the Pep and Tito Villanova era, but that was Real Madrid Barcelona. Those teams hated each other for literally a half a century. So that's already a rivalry before you even throw in the titles into contention. Liverpool Man City is not a rivalry in the historical sense. It's just two teams that are very good and they've come together. So if this you said that they don't match that Arsenal never matched United, and I agree they didn't in the sense that of winning titles, but that every season except for 2000-2001 was a battle between the two of them. 97-98 between the two of them. 98-99 between two of them. 99-2000 between the two of them. Okay, fine. 2000-2001 wasn't. But then 2001-2002 between the two of them. You know, 2003. And then Invincibles was different, obviously. You know, but it's, yeah, for me, I don't think Liverpool have to win the title this year to really make it a real rivalry. Because then it's like back and forth. They're hot potato the title. Then it becomes a thing. Then City have to win again to reestablish their dominance. And maybe then it'll start getting personal, because then it'll be like, hang about. What are you doing taking our crown off us? You know what I mean? They did it once, but City were just as culpable because City were rubbish, you know, in that year when Liverpool won the title. And then City won it back, but Liverpool weren't great either. So it's like, now we've got a genuine sort of rematch. Like Kai says, this is the rematch from 18-19. So if Liverpool can win the rematch, then it becomes a rivalry. If City win it both times it's been close, then it's not really a rivalry, is it?
I agree, and I'm going to say something that no fan of any of the four teams are involved are going to agree with, but in an odd way, Mo, I completely agree with you that this game and this title race will almost define the idea of this rivalry, because at the moment it's Manchester City being dominant and Liverpool keeping them honest. And in a very strange way, Liverpool are the Arsenal in this title race and Manchester City are the Manchester United. Nobody's ever going to agree with me on that, but in those parameters, that is how it is. And I would just say that if you're looking for iconic moments and you're looking for things that you'll remember and you'll pass on, it is all Arsenal, Manchester United, Roy Keane, Patrick Vieira, Arsene Wenger, Sir Alex Ferguson. That's where it is, because that's the Premier League-isms, that's the Sky focus on the Premier League. All of those things will reign forever. Some of the fantastic moments that we've seen in the Manchester City and Liverpool rivalry over the last couple of seasons are only in the domain of those two fans. Every fan of Premier League football remembers Keane against Vieira in the tunnel, Martin Keown against Ruud van Nistelrooy, Pizzagate, Wenger, Ferguson. They remember all of that. They don't remember as much of Manchester City and Liverpool. And for me, if we're talking about iconic moments, that's why it's still Arsenal, Manchester United. But if we're talking about elite football, maybe as growing up a little bit, it is Manchester City against Liverpool. So we're going to call it a day for this week's edition of the Squawker Talker podcast. No one's agreed, but no one ever agrees. So we're keeping up a bit of consistency. We're consistent.
Hey, I agree with you.
Like title challenges, we are consistent. We are the invincibles of the podcasting world. We're going to wrap it up, though. We're going to put a lid on it because we could be here all day, let's be honest. So Mo, Kaya, as always, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Cheers, mate.
Great stuff indeed. We'll be back next week where we're going to have a clearer picture of who is winning the Premier League title, or it's going to be 0-0 at the Etihad and we won't have a clue. Either way, make sure you check out the podcast, hit subscribe up the top, and you can listen to it as soon as it is ready. Thanks so much for listening. Speak to you soon.